Thank you. And I'd also, of course, like to thank the organizers for what's a nice conference, even for an experimentalist. So I'm not going to be talking about this experiment, but it's a system that's closely, it's actually the same physical apparatus. This is work done in my group by the people in bold over here, Jean-Felix Roux, Aaron Reinhardt, and Laura Zundel. And then with theory collaborators, Xuming Li and Anna Maria Ray at JILA, and Rafael Hippolito, who's here, and I guess is going to Georgia Tech. Is that right? Okay. So I'll start off with a brief review of the 1D Bose gas theory with delta function interactions and the experiments, which is, it's going to be brief enough that it shouldn't be a problem for the experts here. But I will highlight the aspects of that I think are most relevant for this work. Then I'll talk about doing experiments with bundles of 1D tubes that actually interact with each other. And then a lot of what we did is attempt to describe the physics of what's going on over there, describe what we actually observed with a mean field description. And the mean field description straight off is a little bit dicey because it's somewhat in the intermediate coupling limit, but we were trying to see if it was possible to adapt a mean field approach to get at essentially what's going on. What we find is that doesn't work that well, and the specific way in which it doesn't work allows us to identify a somewhat qualitatively different kind of self-trapping phenomena that occurs in situations where there's a significant amount of quantum correlations in the system. So I want to, by going through this approach, try to make the case for this new type of self-trapping. So the motivation for starting to look at this was, you know, first that intermediate coupling limit is theoretically hard. So if you have a system where you know it's in the intermediate coupling limit, then it's something of a challenge to theory, as is any non-equilibrium experiments. And because we're doing it in 1D, you can think that maybe it should be easier to actually, doing it near 1D, easier to get some insights and easier to make progress in something which might be something you'd throw up your hands in other situations. And then also this type of self-trapping, which we can see here, seems like it might have more general implications across a range of experiments. So the background model, which is important to the extent when we have 1D systems, is the Leib-Linegar model. It's a very simple model, just delta function interactions with a variable energy range and a kinetic energy term. Those are well-known solutions parameterized by the parameter gamma, which is the coupling strength. The two limits for these solutions are gamma much greater than 1, which is the Tong-Shiarou gas, gamma much less than 1, where the mean field theory description is applicable. And it's useful to think about what's going on over here from the point of view of energy and from the point of view of this cartoon view of wave functions, which it's a view of the correlation of the wave functions. So in the Tong-Shiarou limit, in order to avoid the energy cost of the mean field, correlations develop in the system. So then it's the kinetic energy of these correlations which dominate the total energy, but that's a preferable thing to actually having the mean field energy cost. Whereas if you're in the mean field limit, you don't mind about the mean field energy, and the system therefore can have significant wave function overlap, significant G2. And we can get between, you can tune between these regions by either changing the coupling strength, which to a large degree in our experiments we do by squeezing the atoms more tightly in the tubes, or you can lower the density, which has the same effect, and we can do that by reducing the coupling. I'll show you how. And I just point out here, maybe not necessarily for this audience, but for other audience it's useful, is that this thing, which looks like a bunch of independent wave functions, of course, is just a very highly correlated wave function, right? It's somehow every particle's got to know about every other particle in order to know that it's got to avoid it, although each individual particle is still totally delocalized. The way that general theory, which has been known since the 60s, couples to these experiments was based on work that Maxime did in the late 90s, showing that you can, with a real atom in a waveguide, have a very good approximation of the Leib-Linegar model. where gamma is just related to the 3D scattering length, the transverse confinement, and the 1D density. So what the system looks like is a large blue detuned lattice, a 2D lattice. So those are the big blue beams. And that gives a bundle of tubes. And then we get a confinement when we're loading it and when we're setting up the system. They get confined axially and transversely by a cross-dipole trap, which isn't a lattice, but that just provides this overall trapping potential. So a bundle of tubes, often pictures will look, I'll draw them on the side. I mean, the actual orientation of this experiment is out of the page over here, is up, and we levitate against gravity, so there's no additional forces but what you're seeing over here. If you want to call these just a bundle of 1D tubes, then you'd have to have negligible tunneling between the tubes, which is easy to obtain, but it's also easy to relax that condition. And you also need all the energies to be less than the amount of energy it would take to excite the next vibrational state. And by starting off with a Bose-Einstein condensate, that's fairly easy to achieve. And then in this configuration, we can independently adjust how tightly they are confined transversely by increasing or changing the intensity of the lattice beams, or how tightly they're confined axially by changing the depth or the size of the cross-dipole beams. And those are pretty independent adjustments. That is, when you change the blue detuned lattice depth, it has a very small effect on the axial trapping. So from that, there's a lot of things that you can see, and other similar 1D experiments, a lot of things you could see, but you see the connection, the correlation between, or the way that the experiment represents the theory is pretty accurate. So this is a measurement which we did by photo association of second order correlation function locally. And you see the theory is the blue line, and then the data, the different colors are different densities within the color. It's different amount of squeezing. You see they fall on the line. So in this region over here, that's where you'd expect mean field theory to start apply. This would asymptote to 1. And over here, this is your Planck-Schiardot gas, where the local correlations would go down to 0 in the infinite coupling limit. Okay, so you can get these exact solutions. Another thing that we looked at, actually, this was actually the first thing that we looked at when we set up this experiment, was a bundle of tubes, which you're now looking at edge on. So the tubes are in this direction. And we release them and allow them to expand while the 2D lattice is still on. So we're releasing them from the cross-dipole trap. And they expand, and here they have a certain amount of energy, some of which is, there's different kinds of interaction energy, either the kinetic energy of correlations or mean field energy, and that's released once we no longer trap them, so the atoms expand axially. And from that, you can find out, you can infer what the total energy is. And in doing that, we saw the energy goes up as we increase the lattice depth, and changing the lattice depth is correlated with changing, means that you're changing the coupling strength. And you see, again, with no free parameters, the experiment agrees with the theory pretty well. But we block out this data, because in this data, what you see here is that this is a measure, this sort of little observed curve over here is a measure of the transverse size of the atoms in the trap. And you see they grow at some time if the lattice is sufficiently shallow. If the lattice is deep enough, then there's no expansion transversely, so they are independent tubes. But over here, it's not really a 1D situation. There's this transverse scattering, which is why for this data, we just didn't consider that region. Similarly, at a higher density, we do the same thing, and we didn't consider this region, and we saw that this agrees absolutely well in that regime. But now what I'm going to be doing in this talk is considering this region, because that's exactly the place where we have this bundle of tubes that are coupled with each other, and they're interacting. And if you see what the previous slide was compared to this slide, this expansion is stopped at a much lower lattice depth than the other one. So this is just those two expansion curves on the same graph, where you see at the low density, the atoms expand transversely, even if the lattice depth is as high as 19 or so, whereas for the high density, there's no expansion at all by 12. So I'd shown the initial data some time ago, one of the first times I was talking about the data, and Marcus Oberthaler was in the audience, and he said, oh, that looks like self-trapping, because he'd been studying self-trapping in a different context. And I said, yeah, it does look like self-trapping, and it seemed like, okay, well, we should just clarify that we understand what's going on in this regime. Okay, so just as a reminder, self-trapping in a conventional sense, the most easy to think about it as in a double well system with the Bose-Einstein condensate, is if there's a sufficient mean field energy difference between the two sides, specifically larger than the tunneling width, then the atoms will not Josephson oscillate. And so with not much difference, you see an oscillation. This is from Marcus's lab. And with a sufficient imbalance, you see no oscillation. And you can look in more detail at exactly how the population changes from one side, and it's pretty well described by a mean field theory. Okay, so self-trapping, I would say, is something of a semi-classical kind of result, because there's maybe quantum mechanics in the tunneling, but the mean field is kind of classical. In Oberthaler's lab also, they studied 1D self-trapping in a different context, where they had a bunch of atoms, and there's a stack of pancakes in a 1D lattice. And you see, in that case, you have a density distribution, which is something like this, say a Thomas Fermi distribution. And if you look at the gradient, dn dx, it's the derivative of this, so it's highest at the edge and zero at the middle. And you might say, well, if the general idea of self-trapping would be that there's some threshold over there where the dn dx is sufficiently large that you don't get the tunneling, and so the atoms would be bound from that point. And that's basically what they see, right? So you do a simulation of what would happen, and you see that the atoms can expand in the middle, but they don't expand on the sides. Okay, so the 2D generalization, which is what we started off thinking that that's sort of what we were looking at, is you have now a cylindrically symmetric Thomas Fermi distribution. Still, dn dr is going to give you something which is zero in the center and rises up, and maybe there'd be some self-trapping threshold, and you'd have some dynamics associated with that. That's the thought. So in order to study this, we want to turn off that transverse confinement, the thing which is confining and keeping them from actually tunneling out to the sides. But if we do that, we also turn off the axial confinement. Right. So as the atoms expand axially, the density is really widely varying up along the top to the bottom of the tube. So we concentrate on the 10% of the atoms that are right in the middle. Right. So we just look at that, and we look at the dynamics of that fraction of the atoms. So you say there's a bundle of tubes, and there may be some edge where you might get self-trapping. And we're looking for this transition, something on the fly, right? Because you let them go, the density drops continuously from the beginning of the experiment to the end. And then at some point, the idea is that you hit the point where the density is low enough that it's not self-trapped, and then it would start expanding. So that's what we started off looking at. And we also had this idea that maybe, because you see the expansion of the stuff in the center, if we look from the top, we could see rings or something like that. We see this self-trapped hole forming in the sample. So this is what the data looks like in the axial expansion, which is really pretty much featureless. It's just the width grows here just because of the same reason that I showed you before. The interaction energy is given up, and the atoms expand. And plot the same data in a different way. The peak density is dropping dramatically as a function of time. Or this is the log of the peak density. And you see it's really a large change over that first 10 or 20 milliseconds, getting changes by more than order of magnitude of density. So, and if you look at the other lattice directions, other lattice steps that we studied, it's pretty much the same thing. Okay, so this is, we can use this as a way to tell exactly that we make sure we know what the initial energy of the system, because we're measuring most of the energy coming out in this direction. And but all the other stuff, the interesting stuff, is happening transversely. So you look at the transverse expansion at four different lattice steps. This is what you see. So 7.2 recoil lattices, depth lattice. You see the atoms start to expand at the beginning, and we thought at first when we saw this, oh, that's just no self-trapping. Although there is a little, if you look closely, a little bit of a shape to the way that thing evolves. But then at a deeper lattice depth, around 9, see there's no expansion, then it starts to expand at some point. Deeper lattice still, it waits a longer time, and then it starts to expand, and similarly here, it's a longer time. I note, you know, these temperature time scales are different over here. So this is an even longer time before it expands. So it seemed like it was kind of like what we were qualitatively expecting. If you can just, this isn't a theory fit, this is just, well, look, it looks like a straight line, and then it expands, straight line, and it expands. And that's pretty much the way the data goes. So he said, okay, we should be able to see if we can model that with mean field theory. So I'm not going to go through it, the theory. It's actually non-trivial just because you have a bunch of independent, a bunch of tubes, which then have to, you have to have tunneling from one tube to the next, and you have to be careful that you deal with what happens when you tunnel from one tube to, say, an empty tube adjacent to it. So it's now this work is on the archive, and the details of that are laid clear there. I think when you do a mean field calculation, and in this geometry, this is pretty much what you left off with, right? Coupled tubes, they're coupled at each and every level, and you just evolve it over time using Vanier states within each tube. So the result of that calculation is here. So this is zero time. We're starting off with this thing, which is Thomas Fermi-like. We take at least an assumption that it's Thomas Fermi-like. And then as time goes on, you see there's a little bit of expansion, and the thing is starting to change shape, and it actually becomes kind of square. So you get a square symmetry, first off, which, when you think about it, makes sense, and I'll show you why that is in a moment. And but then this evolves, and it's not really like a trapped edge exactly, but it's something which is changing all the time, including some escape of atoms off of the side. And then eventually, at a large enough point, it releases. But you know, this is a later time. This is 19 milliseconds. But you see it, you know, expands off to the edge. I mean, expands continuously up until some point where then it finally does expand. And if we take a picture, if we plot a different thing, this is just for a deeper lattice depth at some time in a different kind of visualization, you can see that it forms this thing like a fort, where atoms have moved around the center and they haven't actually expanded from the side, but these edges change all the time. Okay, so qualitatively what's going on in the mean field calculation, the reason it becomes square is because, you know, first the atoms are free to tunnel in this direction, but they're self-trapped in this direction along these edges. But over here, the self-trapping point happens at a higher total density, or it's less self-trapped at the same density, just because the density gradient from here to here, the tunneling is the same, but the density gradient is smaller. Right, so that explains why the thing ends up being square, and also just the fact that since the atoms can always move in one direction, even if they don't move in the other direction, it means the density is changing as a function of time. And so what starts off is between two planes, there might be self-trapping. After some time, there isn't, because the density difference has changed the function of time, and then there's maybe self-trapping in a different direction. Right? So it's not really trapping, but they do tend to stay in the same vicinity because of these self-trapping-like effects. Okay, so this is the data at all those points, and we had that theory, here at lowest depth, it's roughly agreeing early on, but then it starts to deviate. It gets a little worse at deeper lattice depth, and then still worse at deeper lattice depth. So clearly, that mean field theory is not describing by a pretty large margin what's going on in these experiments. So the first patch, or the patch that we tried to add to the mean field theory, is to say we could have random phases between the tubes. You know, and that might be because there's some non-elasticity in the turn-on, or some finite temperature, or you start to have correlations building up in the 1D gases. Those correlations bring with them phase fluctuations as you move along the lattice. And if there's phase fluctuations within a tube, then at some point there might be phase fluctuations between the tube. I mean, it's a pretty ad hoc model, but the idea is that these things might be happening. Maybe we can capture them by just randomizing the phase in the mean field model. So, you know, the density looks like this. If you look at what gamma looks like as a function of position in the tube, It's about 0.1 or so in the middle tubes. It diverges off at the end as the density gets very low, but then as the atoms expand axially, the correlation's rising in the middle. So it is, over much of it, it's still some intermediate coupling regime. Right? You might expect to be some less controlled phase from tube to tube. So with these random phases, and we do it with various phase values, this is, for example, at the lowest lattice depth that we looked at with a random phase of 0.4. So totally random phase would be 8 equals 1. No phase difference would be 8 equals 0. And you see that at a very short time, you start to get this kind of self-localization effect, because initially, the tunneling currents are going in all sorts of different directions. And the expansion is significantly slowed down from something like a ballistic expansion, but it is expanding a little bit everywhere at all times as time goes on. That's a later time still. Okay. And this is just another picture of that in the same situation that I showed you before. There's no fort over here. You just have really local large density fluctuations across it, across the sample. So that's our data again. Just to remind you, this is what the pure mean field theory said. Now, when 8 is equals 0.4, which is the best case for here, you see you get a little bit better agreement between the observations and the data with this 8 equals 0.4. That starts to deviate a little bit at the end there. At a higher lattice depth, the best point was 8 equals 0.5, and you see it actually is a little bit worse disagreement everywhere. But that's the best that it will do. It doesn't really capture what's going on. You get the best result at deeper lattice with 8 equals 1, maximum phase noise from tube to tube is the best you can do. And you see, you know, you look at it and you go, okay, well, a lot of times the way these things go, that's pretty good agreement. I just, for reference, I show this is what you put it, if at the lower lattice depth, this is what happens if you put on maximum phase noise. So I say, you know, it could be worse. It's not like an inspiring thing. It's not like something where you can flash up no free parameters. but you know, as the way things go, you say, okay, well, you know, it kind of starts over here. It's got to agree at the beginning, and then it kind of catches up to it, and it's fine. That's not the way we chose to look at this, because we're serious about our error bars, and the error bars, you know, mean something. I mean, we have a certain expectation for what our ability to tell the size is at each of those points. So if we look at these two curves over here, where 8 equals 1 clearly is the best agreement that you're going to get as a functioning eta, so it's an extreme case, but there's a disagreement, and you blow it up, you see that these curves with those error bars over there are pretty far off. I mean, there's several standard deviations, more than 4 or 5 in some cases, off of this curve. So if you say, what's the probability that that mean field theory with maximal fluctuations actually is consistent with this data, it's about 2 × 10⁻⁷ over here for these first 5 points. You know, whether they could really be part of a data set, assuming some Gaussian fluctuations that fit on that line. And you look over here, where, you know, these points over here are pretty far off, it's actually 6 × 10⁻⁹ likely that that is an agreement. Which I would have to say is pretty poor agreement if you look at it in detail. So, you know, go back to the thing which seemed like was going on from the beginning, which is what if you just fit these parts through to a straight line for those early range, and you do the same thing. Well, there's you know, it's half, you know, within 50% of the time you'll have this much deviation from a straight line over that thing, if in fact the underlying physics is a straight line. And over here, it's a little lower, but it's still pretty good agreement, basically, with a straight line. So I take it to mean that straight line's better physics. Now you say it's such a small difference, it seems like, you know, maybe, you know, aren't we just paying too much attention to a really tiny thing? But you remember the density is dropping nearly exponentially at that early time. So if you look at the density over here, which is kind of the where this line over here from the theory crosses this red line, the density is about 4 times higher than the density where this thing actually is observed to go up. Right. So we're having self-trapping that's occurring at a much lower density than even the most extreme mean theory would say. And the same thing over here, it's more than a factor of 4, 4.5 between where this thing hits and this thing hits. So, and it's, you know, it's basically this early time where there's always a little bit of expansion. It seems like there's no expansion, not just at the edge, but there's no expansion anywhere in for this whole collection of atoms. So what you see by the fact that this is totally flat is that you have self-trapping everywhere, and there is no requirement of a density gradient, because even in the center where you expect there's no density gradients, you get nothing. Okay, and it's just, it is flat out, I would say, inconsistent with any direct application of mean field theory you can have. So the question is, why does that happen? You know, what is going on? And I think I can get a qualitative explanation, although I think the detailed calculation may be somewhat beyond the state of the art, but at least the hand waving explanation is totally within the state of the art at this point. So you have atoms with correlations in one tube and then in all the adjacent tubes. And the reason the atoms have those correlations is because they've built the correlations up in order to avoid the energy cost of having overlap of the wave functions, right? They're avoiding a mean field energy. But if you take an atom from one tube with its particular correlations that have been built in order to avoid these mean field energy, and you have a tunnel to the adjacent food, to the adjacent tube, then suddenly it's got to pick up all that mean field energy that it avoided. You know, it can't tunnel with the appropriate correlations to not, with the adjacent tube, to not have that energy cost. And if you're in the intermediate coupling limit, that's a large fraction of the total energy, right? So this is a situation where you don't need to have any, density gradient. It's just the fact of the correlations being in the wave function have made it so that there's this suppression of the ability to tunnel. It's too energetically costly. So it's like self-trapping, but it requires these quantum correlations in your many-body system. And I suspect that, you know, this is not just a 1D phenomena. It's in any situation where you make a change to some Hamiltonian and you expect that there's going to be some mass flow, you have to worry about whether a system which already has some correlations built into it can actually flow in mass. Because, and this is something you don't see if all you're doing is modifying a mean field theory to say, it's effectively a smaller mean field energy. That's the effect of the correlations. It's much more specific than that. It's the microscopic correlations that exist in the sample are the thing which is preventing you from going to the nearby point. So anyway, I suspect that it's more general than this. And I just, as the last piece of data to show, if you look at the places where the untrapping starts, so just here, you know, these points over here, which, you know, it's a little bit noisy, we just sort of draw a line, and that's why there's a pretty big error bar. If you look at where that happens as a function of lattice depth, then it's pretty constant over this range where we can actually see that, which is to say that it really looks like it is the total mean field energy of the, probably dominated by the things that are in the center, that has to drop below some point before then everything is basically going to be released. And, you know, that's consistent with everything I just said. Okay, so in summary, if you have mean field theory, if you apply that, because you certainly could do this experiment in a situation with low enough coupling strength that mean field theory would apply, then you don't really have self-trapping because of the geometry. You have something more like a localization for a pretty long period of time. And then if you try to modify the mean field theory in this way by introducing random phases, you know, it's unclear that it's just not slightly coincidental, but it does capture the behavior at a lower left lattice depth. As long as this is a pretty small correction, you can capture the behavior of that small correction by adding these random phases. But once you get into this range where the lattice depth is larger, then it's just there's no way to get that what's observed by sticking only to mean field theory. In particular, what we see is that we see self-trapping when there are no gradients at all. So this is really a more completely quantum mechanical effect, if you want, because it's the quantum correlations that are suppressing the tunneling. Although certainly it's because the energy cost is ultimately mean field, that plays some sort of role still. And I suggest finally that if there's any situation where you have mass flow and you're trying to imagine going from one situation to another, this is a reason why everything might just lock up. Make it so that you'd expect, I know what the lowest energy state is, but you can't get there because correlated gases are really not that mobile. Thank you for your attention.
David, to paraphrase the last argument you gave, it sounds like you're arguing that the initial state is basically a mod insulator, that you can't, because there's an energetic cost for creating particle hole pairs, there's no transport. And I know it's an unusual mod insulator because you don't have a lattice in the vertical direction, but on the other hand, the correlations that you've built up in your 1D gas establish a lattice-like arrangement of atoms, which is this correlation.
If by mod insulator you mean that there is, past a certain point, a fixed number of atoms in each tube, then yes, I mean, there's a fixed number of atoms in each tube. If there's no tunneling, then you've locked in the number of atoms. I don't think it maps onto some physics of mod insulator at all, right? It's more, it's still described by some Liebig-Linegar gas within each tube, and then tube to tube, it's just that you've prevented mass transport.
Right, but again, the argument for insulation in the mod insulator is simply that there's a gap for creating particle hole pairs.
Yeah, right. It's just that
if I
were to set up a situation where there's some random number of atoms, you have these correlations and there's random numbers at each site, I think it still wouldn't flow. I'm saying there's nothing which is sort of flattening out the distribution at some point. There's just something which is locking the dynamics as you move forward in time. Right, so I don't know for sure if I'm exactly disagreeing with any substantive point, but I just, if you hit this, there's nothing which is working to tend to give you a flat distribution. It's only working to prevent evolution.
Dave, to build on this equation, I'm not sure I understood what you have in mind as your hand-waving model. Do you mean that first, in each tube, you have correlation between the atoms, and second, there is correlation from one tube to the next one? So for instance, when you have a maximum presence in one tube, you would have just a minimum in front of it. So
no.
In order to minimize the overlap or?
Sorry, what I'm saying is that in each tube, there are correlations in the 1D gases.
Yes.
And you can have, they could be exactly the same correlations in the adjacent tube. It could literally be the exact
same. Sure, but having the same correlation in the adjacent tube mean that they alternate.
No, but I'm saying that they could be correlated with each other, they can be uncorrelated, so it doesn't make any difference. The point is that because when it tunnels, it loses the benefit of the correlations that it has in its own tube, it almost doesn't make any difference. As long as there are atoms in the adjacent tube, it almost doesn't make any difference what the correlations are in that tube.
But don't you think that what I suggest improve on the benefit in energy? If you have a kind of correlation between the two adjacent tubes so as to have a maximum in front of a minimum, so you minimize the interaction energy, so it could be an extra correlation.
I guess
it's just hand waving, okay?
But right. I mean, I don't think there's any way to develop that sort of correlation, but I would also say that I'm worried that that's a little bit of an abuse of the cartoon.
Ah, okay.
Right? Because
this is why I'm asking about the cartoon.
When I draw something which is a hump here and a hump here and a hump here, it doesn't mean that there's an atom here with a little gap and an atom here. There is no such order. If you look any place along that tube, you're equally likely to have an atom.
Yes, so I know. I understand this.
So it's a model which is only looking at the second order correlations.
I just suggest you could go further in looking for different correlations. And in addition, in going from a square distribution to triangular correlation, you would have things like frustration, etc., etc. It would be fun for theorists.
So, David, the argument is very similar to the argument one gives in solid-state physics for tunneling, say, into electron wires, that it's difficult to put in an electron because it's a many-body state inside the wire. And so in that case, it typically leads to sort of power law dependence of the tunneling on, say, the voltage applied, sort of, I guess in your case, that would be some kind of power law as a function of strength of the interaction, which you can probably vary. So, but I, okay, that's just a comment, maybe like your flat regions should, I don't know if it's...
Before you ask your question, can I make a comment on their comment? I would say that, you know, that physics, say the physics, you know, if you look at what would happen over here, if you just had a Fermi gas in one tube and another tube, you would also have the suppression. If you had a Tang Shiro gas, you'd have the suppression because it would be too much, it would be infinite energy cost to go from one tube to the next. Right, so the physics of Fermi systems or Tang Shiro system is very similar to the physics that's going on over here, except for that the correlations are just far less complete. You know, you don't need complete correlations, you just need to have enough correlations to affect the energy.
Actually, I disagree with that. I don't think it's just the correlation, fermionic correlation, because like if it's tunneling of non-interacting fermion to non-interacting fermion, to just measure the density of states. So the
right,
fact,
no, but I'm saying, but the reason you can't tunnel is because if you have your non-interacting fermions and it's a low, zero temperature state, there's just no state for tunneling.
For fermions, there are states.
Like
I think the point is that what is tunneling is a boson, not a fermion. You see, a fermion is some non-local operator constructed out of bosons. But what tunnels is an actual boson, that's why it's more complicated. But my analogy was not to non-interacting fermions, but to interacting fermions. So power law you get only when you put in interactions between fermions. So,
yeah, and I'd be curious to know if there's a way to predict a particular power law dependence and then extract it. I mean, you know, maybe not from this exact experiment, but from some similar experiment.
But so my question is, what is a Luttinger parameter or gamma, just to get an idea which regime you're in your system?
So I showed you this curve where first it's different for different tubes you go across there. So gamma is around 0.1 in the middle, and it diverges at the edge. So it's gamma, Luttinger parameter. Someone else could probably do the conversion
that's
quicker.
The temperature for the diaphragm.
Right, but then as so the this gamma of 0.1, say in the middle, then has a density which drops. So it's a little bit of an open question. Then, can you just get what the correlations are left in the middle by looking at the new density which is going down, or is it probably somewhat fewer correlations than you'd have if you did an equilibrium calculation at the lower density? But I would say, you know, the gamma is 0.1 and then it's rising. Probably it's greater than 1, and I don't know where it gets to before it actually gets untrapped.
So essentially, your argument can be quantified from a knowledge of the Green's function and the one-body functions in Lieb-Linegar, right?
Yeah, I mean,
so
I think,
you know,
I think it must be possible to, even if you can't solve for the entire wave function, to quantify this argument based on that.
These functions can be plotted, you know, with high accuracy over the whole dynamical region. So then whatever process you're asking, if you want to know the rate for these things, you can just write the proper integral
right.
for these things.
I would just point out that, you know, if you try to model in more detail besides, you know, past this hand waving approach, the things that you have to worry about are the fact that atoms in different tubes are expanding at different rates.
Right.
And then there's this whole time-dependent process as it goes on. So, I mean, I'd say we would have done something like that now, you know, given this idea. He's okay, now we have a way to approach it, except for that if you're going to look at that in great detail, it's a little bit of a mess. I mean, it's more of a commitment than a little calculation.
Would it be possible to independently vary the gamma parameter and the mean field parameter? So you hold mean field dynamics exactly fixed and then vary gamma and see what difference it makes.
I think that specific change where you keep the mean field parameter fixed and change gamma is probably tough because everything that you do to change gamma, including any of the three handles that you in principle have are also going to affect the mean field parameter. But I mean, if you had one other degree of freedom, then you could imagine having, at least cuts through curves like what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right. But I think what you would need is you would need the ability to change the scattering length at the same time, and then that would give you the, and it could be done, say, with cesium.